But if I want to make real change in society, I have to be an advocate for a mission. Every day I've got to think about it.
That was Dr. Allison Barber, President and Chief Operating Officer for Indiana Fever, talking about how she uses her educational background to help athletes become advocates, increase inclusion, and broaden the impact of the Fever organization. And this is IBJ's The Freedom Forum with Angela B. Freeman. Dr. Barber, welcome to the Freedom Forum, and thank you so much for being our 2024 Women's History Month guest. As I'm certain you appreciate, this year has been and will continue to be a huge one for sports and major events in Indianapolis. As such, I've been speaking with some of the major forces behind our sports organizations in the city, including the Indiana Fever. However, before we get started, will you please tell our listeners a bit about you, your educational and professional background, and any other factors that have led to you becoming the president and chief operating officer for the Indiana Fever?
Thank you for having me on the show. I think I'd be happy to unpack a little bit of my background. It's perfect to do during Women's History Month because most of my opportunities and challenges have been inspired by women. And first and foremost, my mother. I was a first grade school teacher, grew up in Northwest Indiana, and my mom's a school teacher. So I was inspired by her profession and her passion for helping children learn, and that inspired me to also teach. So I started off, I'm in my eighth career, not job, but career. And so I went from being a school teacher to finding our way into Washington, D.C. The first Gulf War broke out. My husband is a Notre Dame lawyer, a Notre Dame alum, was practicing law. And when the first Gulf War broke out, he came home and said he wanted to serve the country. And so we both quit our jobs and got stationed in New Jersey. And then with my new job opportunity for me with the American Red Cross, we moved to Washington, D.C. Spent 20 years in D.C., working in nonprofit, president of an ad agency, and then being selected by President Bush and his team to go to work in the Pentagon during the Bush administration, and spent 7 years there in and out of the White House for probably about 7 or 8 months doing special projects for the president and his team, which was also great. And then went into teaching at Georgetown as an adjunct. And then God just laid it on our heart that it was time to move home to be with family. My parents had relocated from the region down here to Indy. My dad was a construction engineer in charge of construction management at Ball State. So we moved back home, and I reached out to then Governor Mitch Daniels and said, you know, is there anything I can do to be helpful in the state of Indiana? And he asked me to start WGU Indiana, our state's nonprofit online university. So I did that. And then on a Friday, I got a call from the leadership at Pacer Sports and Entertainment asking me if I would consider talking to them about being the president of the Fever. And so 8 careers, often and always inspired by women. Now this job, of course, is so focused on opportunity and opening doors and breaking down barriers for women that it seems like a great fit and a terrific conversation for this month.
So you mentioned your long career and focus on education, and you also mentioned your time at the Pentagon, your time at the White House, and that included some time at the Department of Defense, which I think you mentioned. What was your role there? What were you doing there? And what did you learn about yourself, about your career aspirations during your time there?
My job at the Pentagon was twofold. One, I was in charge of all of the global communication for the military to the troops around the world. So running television and Stars and Stripes newspaper to troops in 147 countries. And then also being I was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. And so those roles were far reaching. And then also in charge of connecting Americans to the mission of the military. And that job taught me many things. So I went into the Pentagon in May of 2001, and we were so busy. I'd never been in politics or in government service before. Working at the Pentagon was intense. And then 9/11 happened, and it changed everyone's world. It changed the tempo of our work and our pace and our mission. It really crystallized our focus. And that was really very, very intense. But the big competencies I learned along the way were really to focus. After 9/11 happened, one day I got a call, and the Secretary of Defense was Secretary Rumsfeld. His wife wanted to visit the wounded in the hospital from the Pentagon. And so I went with her. And then my job then became meeting with the families of people who had lost somebody in the Pentagon, And that expanded to my work with the families. And I think I learned in that moment the competency that no matter how big the mission, no matter how big the challenge, it's important to spend time with the people who are impacted by the crisis. And so I think I learned the people side of the business in that role. It makes sense for a school teacher to care about the people first and foremost. And I think I started some of those seeds were probably planted early in my career. They were matured in that role in the Pentagon. And then when I came to WGU, it was go to all 92 counties of the state of Indiana to meet with people. So they knew they had a new opportunity to get a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, a life-changing opportunity that was affordable. You couldn't do that from an office looking out your window. You had to be with the people. And then when I came to the Fever, you know, we were a franchise in transition coming off of a winning career and ready to rebuild. And what I found to be really helpful was to spend time with the fans and to be with the people. And so for my style of engagement and leadership, I like being with the people who make the mission happen. And so I probably learned that first and foremost in the deepest and most valuable ways after 9/11 at the Pentagon.
That is so, so powerful. And we've talked about it so many times on this show about being a true foundation of diversity is being interested in people and their differences and their, you know, disparities and their challenges and the things that they have overcome to get to whatever position they've gotten to. So it's interesting to see how that is the thread that has woven through your 8 careers. You talked about your time as an adjunct professor at Georgetown, as well as being the chancellor of WGU in Indiana. And I appreciate that women, I've learned, because I've never personally been in academia as a career, but I've learned that women in academia and education truly face their own challenges and barriers with regard to institutional biases and challenges related to advancement. And that's probably not that atypical from any other career, right? But what did you learn about yourself in that time when you were involved in academic leadership? And again, similar to your transferable skills from the time in the Pentagon, what transferable skills did you glean from that time in academia that you've now been able to apply to your role at the Indiana Fever?
Angela, I've had the chance to work with so many amazing women who have given voice and opportunity to this thinking about what's the space for women and what's the opportunity. Elizabeth Dole, a former senator, former cabinet secretary, wife of the late Bob Dole, was the president of the Red Cross when I was working at the Red Cross. And I remember her saying one time, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, it matters if you're the best at your job. And the working hard pays off. And so are there biases and discrimination? Yes, is the answer. Are we better today than we were when Elizabeth Dole was charting her course? Thankfully, yes. There's more room for this too. But what I found, I keep a sign on my wall. It says, be a voice, not an echo. And I think I gleaned some of that from Elizabeth's pursuit of saying, be excellent. And stand up for things that are right to stand up for and fight for things, but not because you're a woman, but because you're the best in the job. Now, in fairness, some men will respect that. I have worked for men that respect it and treated me as equals. I have worked with men who discount it. And I think sometimes you find that because sometimes women work differently, collaborative sometimes more than men, relational, emotional intelligence might be different. I'm not saying these things are always true, just some trends that you might see. So for sometimes that looks like a weak leader instead of a collaborative leader. And so it's your best day when you work in a diverse society, a diverse workforce where people respect the differences. And I've had some really great experiences and I've had some really tough ones. But I don't think I'll ever embrace a tougher environment than working at the Pentagon, which was military and government and politics and very heavily weighted on the man side of the scale. But in that moment, I've worked for secretaries of defenses and presidents of the United States who respected women because they were married to strong women. And I think that might be the secret sauce.
That's really impressive and such a good way to look at sometimes really challenging situations. But I agree with you. At the end of the day, hard work, excellence always wins, right? No matter who it's coming from. And I live my life and try to drive my career in that way too. You've talked about your 8 different careers, and you know that I'm a former scientist turned lawyer. And I always get asked how and why I made that career transition. And so I'm certainly interested to better understand how and why you made the transition you made over the course of your many careers. And more so, I focus on this with you and Mel and so many others who've made career transitions, because I often think that some of our early professionals think a career progression is just linear. You just go from one step to the next until at some point you're sitting in the C-suite, right? And I want people to know that that's not typical. And it is even more common that your career progression kind of weaves and winds. For people like you and I, is weaved and wound in and out of different industries, right? And different facets. So when you were first starting off in your career path, what did you aspire to do? And you mentioned being a teacher. Were you aware of all the career opportunities that were really available to you? And when did you realize you had a unique opportunity to lead and influence in a way that would allow you to transfer some of the skills that you've talked about from not just different jobs or positions or even careers, but different fields and different industries, like from education to sports?
When I was growing up, I wanted to be the president of my own company. I was in high school. I didn't know a female who was the president of her own company. And I grew up in a conservative Christian school where women were not career oriented in that way. They were teachers or nurses, maybe stay-at-home moms if that was their choice. So I didn't see a path to being the president of my own company. I went to school to be a school teacher and loved it, taught for 6 years. But I realized as I was teaching and I was trying to teach my students to love learning, that my learning wasn't being developed. Now, a lot of teachers continue to self-develop and they're great at it. I needed external friction to keep growing. And so that's when I realized that at a certain point for me, I love starting. I love risk. When Mitch said, please start WGU Indiana, it's like nobody had ever heard of it. I love that space of really hard risk, brand building, take the chance, see what you can make work. Once something gets to a good, stable place, then it's time for me to move to the next place. And this is what I try to encourage people to think about, is what your skill sets are for this current job might have a shelf life and you'll get bored or static. So you should be always looking for the next thing. Not that you're not loyal and doing your job currently, but where's your curiosity take you? And so down the road in one of my careers, I just decided to start my own PR firm, mostly because we were in a military transition time. My husband was supposed to go to Germany, so I'd quit my job. I was unemployed, waiting for our deployment orders. And at the time, I started babysitting for my girlfriend who just had a baby, visiting my friend Michelle, who was dying of cancer, and volunteering for the Red Cross. I'm a big-time Red Cross volunteer. I'm doing this every week and every month, and our Army orders kept getting delayed, and then they got canceled. So now I had to find a job, and I wanted to find a job. I was so fortunate. I went on job interviews, and I got lots of interview opportunities. It was wonderful, humbling. And I looked at each of these 9 job offers, and I said, if I take any of those jobs, I won't be able to babysit for Missy, visit Michelle, or volunteer. So I turned them all down and started my own PR business because I wanted to live out those priorities. They were my higher calling at that time. And when somebody said, oh, what are you going to be, the CEO of your own company? And then it dawned on me, I'm like, I can be the president of my own company. So to your point, no, I never thought I'd have my own business. I never saw a path to it, but I was open to it. And that's part of the important journey, is being open. Look at where you are. You had to have an openness to go back to college, to get a degree, to law degree, to move on. And so it starts with curiosity and openness for me and for a lot of people I talk to, and then taking a chance.
Taking the risk, betting on yourself, right? We talk about that a lot. As you have experienced your many career opportunities and your ascension to leadership, right, in women's sport, What have you found have been particular strengths that you bring to your team? What challenges or barriers have you faced? And how have you personally navigated your own authenticity within the workspace such that your peers and colleagues, people who report to and through your organization, feel that same value and the opportunity to explore their curiosities?
I'll tell you, the biggest challenge of this job in a leadership standpoint has been that the harder I work and develop my team on the business side, it doesn't necessarily impact the one thing we are most measured for in sports, and that's, did you win or did you lose? That's been a huge learning curve for me to say, okay, this is my role. How do we grow the business, the fandom, partners, all of these wonderful community engagement pieces? And it's someone else's role, my general manager and coach, to deliver on the product everybody's watching. That has been a fascinating learning journey for me. And so I think what you learn in that space is do what you can do for the broader mission and trust people to do what they can do. And that's part of sports, is you can't do it all. And you know, because in corporate America or nonprofit, you're touching most of the tentacles of the organization as the leader. And you're responsible at the end of the day for all of the business practices. And so that's been a really fun, sometimes uncomfortable learning journey for me. But it works from a standpoint of saying, do what I can do and trust others to do what they can do.
I appreciate that transparency, because I've heard many leaders say that, you know, the best leaders trust their team to do what they're good at doing. But I also appreciate that when you grow up in a career like mine in law, where you're primarily responsible, right? No matter what the team's doing, it's hard sometimes to give up that control and allow people to be their best selves and do what they do. It's part of what develops a well-functioning team, is that each person has that trust in the other to do their best, right, in whatever role they're given.
And I think it's important to remember where you were at your age, the bosses that empowered you. I mean, we have a great staff for the Fever. I spend more time buying cookies for ticket salespeople and Starbucks cards than I do selling tickets, because I need them to, I'm so proud of them. And I want to build into them. This is their new career. And when I worked at the Pentagon, one time I was getting a young soldier to interview the president of the United States, and he was 22 years old. And someone came to me in that team and said, you can't let a 22-year-old interview the president of the United States. And I said, well, how old are the people that land those planes on the aircraft carriers? Because that seems dangerous. And they're 22. We're talking about an internal television interview with the soldier and the president. I'll take that risk. But you know what I'm saying? Like, you've got to step back a minute and say, what exactly are we worried about? We embedded reporters with our military when they invaded Iraq, and people were wringing their hands. It's like, what are we worried about? So sometimes I think that's a different perspective to say, I'm going to trust my team, because as a leader, if you don't empower them, then you have to make all the decisions. That's not helpful. And you're not growing anybody. And then if something goes wrong, help them learn from it. You don't fire the person who makes a mistake. You don't punish them. You help them learn from it. And usually they are better for it.
That's that opportunity to have lifelong learnings, right? And Lord knows we've all, you know, made some bad decisions and had an opportunity to rebound, learn, and grow. So down to the brass tacks of your current role. I told Mel Raines when she was here, and I'll tell you the same, I know nothing about running a professional basketball organization. As a basketball fan and even a basketball mom of a college player, I can appreciate all that goes into putting on what is really some great performances. It's not just a basketball game, to your point, right? It's all that goes with it. The fan opportunities, the gimmicks, the advertisements, the players, all the excitement. And so I totally appreciate that there's a lot that goes with all that, particularly in women's sports, where I would assert that there still remains some disparities in maybe pay, resources, visibility, etc., despite notable and continued progress to date. So describe for us your day-to-day, what your day-to-day job entails, how you're able, again, to influence and make change for the Fever organization and for women's sports generally, because one of the things you mentioned is that you have the opportunity now to impact women in a way that you may not have in past lives or careers. And then finally, what successes have you had to date that you're really proud of and hope to see go forward for Fever's future?
I think sports is similar to every other career in this way, is that you use data to build a case for the best predictable outcomes. And then you mix into it your intuition and instincts and your experience. When I got this job, I said, I want Fever fans in all 92 counties. And people weren't sure we could do that because we weren't in all 92 counties. And I said, well, you know, or you have to win to have fans. I said, I reject that because I'm a Cubs fan and Cubs fans never win, but we love the Cubs. So my point is, how do you create a culture that people want to support and be a part of? I think we've done a pretty good job of that. And it starts with our ownership and our leadership and all the people who work at Pacer Sports Entertainment that say we're all in for the Fever. I think that's been one of our success stories, is that the brand and the connection has been strong in our city. And I think as we grow, we will become stronger in the state and then the region because of social media, things that we didn't have when we won the championship years ago. There wasn't that kind of reach that we'll have that. But I think every day, you know, every day I get up and I think about how do we build a better future for girls and women in sports, in the business side of sports, not just the athletes, but people who want to be coaches or people want to have my job and other jobs. So how do we carry the torch in the right way that inspires people, educates people about it, and then inspires people to pursue that? Because it's a wonderful opportunity to bring people together, unlike any other profession that I've experienced.
Let's talk a little bit about the Fever specifically, because you've talked about this opportunity to influence women. And I'd argue that certainly women, and we've talked about it, face their own challenges. And I'm sure the team, the WNBA and its fans, unquestionably comprise one of the biggest contingents of not just women, but diverse women, particularly women of color and LGBTQ women. And particularly in our current political climate, when the rights of women, diverse women, LGBTQ plus sisters are becoming more challenged or maybe even rolled back at some levels, how involved is the Indiana Fever in using their social and political capital to influence how our state and even our national government addresses some of these pressing women's issues? And then I'll even go further to ask, specifically when you all, and this may not be your job specifically, but when the Indiana Fever is looking to ensure rights of women, particularly regarding your players and potential recruits, how does that political climate in Indiana affect, you know, your ability to recruit women to Indiana to want to come play here, live here, and grow a family here or not?
Well, now you're going to really pull out the teacher in me. When I first got this job, I thought, oh, this would be so wonderful to try and help and inspire players to think about their next career. I'd love to write the curriculum called The Locker Room to the Boardroom. You know, 92% of C-suite females played sports. But how can we be intentional about that pathway? And then about a year into it, I realized, oh, my players are really more focused on their current career. They're not quite at that point yet. They're playing sports and this is what they're going to maximize. And then COVID happened in the bubble and the crisis in our country around social injustice happened. And Angela, it just hit me so hard. Like, wait a minute, are we equipping our athletes to be advocates and to really take on the issues they care about? And so in my first year, I learned it's not what I care about for them. I transitioned to being a leader of saying, what do you care about and how do we equip you? And so thanks to IU School of Philanthropy and Anthem, who funded this, we wrote a new curriculum called Athlete to Advocate, because I was concerned about athletes who were sharing their personal brand to give a message that they weren't committed to. And so I designed this concept of saying you're either you can be an amplifier of a message, vote, or you can be an advocate of a mission. And they're both important, but they're very different. if I'm going to amplify your message, I'm just going to tweet about it, wear it on my t-shirt, show up for your 5K. But if I want to make real change in society, I have to be an advocate for a mission. Every day I've got to think about it. And so every WNBA team has kind of charted their own course. Our style and really philosophical approach is, how about if we really get to know our players and help them develop what they care about and equip them? So my players go through a 5-week professional certificate program with the School of Philanthropy, Athlete to Advocate, because I think that's how you make lasting change. And so I guess there are a lot of issues that are important issues, but my job is to advocate for what my players care about, because that will be meaningful to them. And that is how change will happen.
That's very powerful. And it's good to know that they're getting that kind of education, because they have a unique and rare platform that they absolutely can maximize to make impact in the issues that they care about. And that's what I think athletes should do, particularly athletes like women, and maybe women who are underrepresented, who've never had the opportunity to really advocate or be in a position to have a platform to make influence and make impact on issues that they care about. So it's great that you all are going back to the educator in you, giving them that education, which they will focus on and be foundational as they go forward. I mean, they can use that the rest of their life.
Yes. And then it's authentic.
That's right.
You know, you and I both, we both have seen spokespeople who don't care about the product they're talking about. And it's so obvious. And change never happens in meaningful ways unless you want to commit to it.
Yeah, that passion has to be real and purposeful. Now it's time for a quick break.
Get caught up on the state's top business news every business day with the Inside Indiana Business Radio On Demand podcast. Available now at InsideIndianaBusiness.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with Dr. Allison Barber, President and Chief Operating Officer for Indiana Fever, on this Women's History Month episode of the Freedom Forum with Angela B. Freeman. So let me ask you a question that I see myself asking relatively often these days, because it's something that kind of presses on me, and I want to get other people's perspective on this. I talked to Mel about this and so many of our other guests, so I'm going to ask you and you tell me your thoughts. You mentioned data previously, that data really drives how you can make impact and make change, kind of forms that baseline. And we've seen, based on DE&I data over the last 2 decades or so, that we've been collecting data on DE&I in corporate spaces and in the workplace, that, you know, the primary beneficiaries of the last couple decades of DE&I movements and initiatives and programs have primarily been Caucasian or white women. And that continues to be across the board, every field, every industry, et cetera. But we don't see that same even progression or increase in diverse women, underrepresented women, women of color, LGBTQ women, et cetera. And so my thought is that it seems to me that it's possible that white women who have found themselves in positions of influence are not necessarily passing that influence on to more diverse women, such that you don't see any increase in diverse women at C-suite levels, executive levels, in corporate spaces, etc. So I want to know your thoughts around this and whether you think there are any responsibility for Caucasian women or white women who do have positions to help underrepresented women also seek those same levels of success and influence. What are your thoughts around that?
I think to whom much is given, much is required. So when women have these opportunities, it is important for us to provide those opportunities to others. I'm fortunate, you mentioned it on the top of this conversation, the Fever team is very diverse. It's organic to who we are. And so that's really helpful, because we don't have to spend time thinking about that one piece. Every community we go into, and we're running basketball camps, or we're doing STEM conferences, or whatever, we demonstrate and exhibit diversity because of the makeup of our team. I do know our company has been very committed to raising opportunities for the minority and, you know, the diverse populations. And I'm hoping you saw that through the All-Star activities and how we had, I think, nearly 30 minority-owned businesses that were certified, and we had more representation at the HBCU game than any other. So, you know, this is what I was talking about, how sports can bring people together. I think our company is very, very focused on that. You know, some of my volunteer work, I'm the chair of the board of the Sagamore Institute, and we do so much work in the space of minority entrepreneurship. And what inspires me in that space, Angela, is preparation. There are so many great quotes in sports, but, you know, success is wherein preparation meets opportunity. So I think when you talk about Caucasian women who have already charted this course, maybe ahead of the minority females, I think that's right. But what did we learn is that you have to be prepared for when the opportunity comes. And I think we're seeing a lot of growth in that space, and it's exciting.
I appreciate that. And when you talk about excitement, man, there's some excitement building right now. In the city, the buzz is happening. We've been hearing rumors and mumbles and chants along the way, but we've just heard that Caitlin Clark of Iowa will be in the 2024 WNBA draft, and she's unquestionably a force to be reckoned with. It's so exciting that Indiana will have an opportunity for her to be here and call it home. Can you give us some insights on what your team has planned with regard to drafting Caitlin or her role on the team or whatever you could share? And how do you anticipate having her here in Indianapolis will impact the support and visibility of the Fever, the players, and the city generally?
Caitlin Clark is a wonderful athlete, and I've never met her, but seems like a wonderful person. And so how great for women's sports to have an ambassador such as Caitlin. We won't know till draft day, April 15th. So you'll know when I know if Indiana Fever gets Caitlin Clark. We do have the first pick in the draft, and we're excited that, and we hope that all things work out that way. What an honor it would be to bring her into our community if that's what works out on April 15th. And so that would be great. But I'll tell you what, you know, you get this because you've been in business. No one person is the savior of a company or nonprofit or team. So the first pick that we draft will be coming into a really terrific team already. Aaliyah Boston from our first pick last year, Lexi Hall and Erica Wheeler and Kelsey Mitchell. It just goes on and on. Grace Berger from IU. I mean, you look at across our franchise team, we have people that have won at the highest levels. We have a franchise that has won at the highest level. You know, the Fever had a championship with Tamika. And so whoever we draft in that first pick will be coming into a team that is already making great strides and will be successful. And so, you know, I think as in the leadership side of the house, and our head coach, Chrissy Sides, is masterful and will manage the locker room perfectly. I'm sure she will. But it's about how do you teach people to now come together. It's not like, it really isn't different than corporate America. You bring in a new vice president and all the directors are like, oh my gosh, what's this going to be like? It just takes a minute. You have to give people time. You have to give people the benefit of the doubt. And you have to stay focused on the bigger goal. And our goal is winning games, entertaining fans, and having an impact in our community. So that's, you know, we sketched out our three C's for the Fever: commit, compete, and contribute. How can we commit individually to be the best people we can be? How do we compete for fandom and goodwill, wins, partners, fans, all the things? But then how do we contribute back into the community? And so I think the first pick, I mean, people are thrilled about Caitlin Clark for good reason. If she comes to Indiana, I think she'll fit into our culture beautifully. And most importantly, will also fit into our community beautifully. And so people are excited. Whoever we get at the first pick will be awesome, and thrilled for our fans that are energized and loyal.
I think you said it best. we already have a wonderful WNBA franchise. We've had a history of success, you know, dating back to Tamika and beyond, and she continues to be involved with your leadership to make it an awesome franchise. I can tell you, as being a translocated person to Indianapolis, how wonderful this community embraces those who come here, particularly with the intent and opportunity to do goodwill and continue to contribute to this community. So we are super excited for what possibly may come in Indiana this upcoming WNBA season. I've got my tickets. I will be
Thank you. Absolutely.
To represent and support. And so as we wind up, I want to ask you kind of a high level picture. We've drilled down a bit, and I want to come back up high level because you have had quite a bit of history. You're from here. You've been away from here and come back here. So as you look at Indiana's progression with regard to diversity, equity, and inclusion in our corporate environments and our corporate workspaces, particularly as you lead one of Indiana's largest sports organizations, what do you believe are some of the greatest advances Indiana companies have made as a collective with regard to catalyzing more opportunities for diverse and inclusive workspaces in our corporate environment? And what other tools or tips or resources would you provide or suggest to Indiana corporate leaders who want to continue making progress and continue pushing the ball forward such that folks like new generations of women and Hoosiers like Caitlin Clark want to come here and call it home?
We've had a lot of great success in this state over the last many years. I think about opportunity, and I can't help but make one more plug for WGU Indiana that provided education pathways that were affordable online. People didn't have to have a car to get to a campus. They could work a job. And sure, I'm an educator, so of course I think most things start and stop with education because it opens doors. And so I think our state and our Commissioner of Higher Ed has worked so hard to provide more opportunities for people of all races, economic backgrounds, and I think that's a good starting point. So when you look at the state of Indiana and the grant money we give out and the partnership with Ivy Tech, we are leaning into saying to people, you can be educated, which will open doors for yourself. And so that is foundational to the success of our state. Our governor and IEDC are going out, bringing in great businesses, which generate more jobs that people have to be educated for. So this formula is working and coming together. But if we really want to continue to make advances, it kind of reminds me of one day when I was at basketball practice and our GM, Lyndon, was sitting next to me and she's like, well, they need to practice free throws for 5 minutes. I said, well, what good does 5 minutes do? And she said, well, it's better than no minutes. And when I think about our role in advancement for people, everybody can do something. So whether you, and it starts in small ways, you're going to a networking group, make sure you're taking somebody with you who would not on their own be invited to that, because now you're going to open doors and build their network. And so everybody can do something. And we sit back sometimes and think companies need to start their own programs to focus. And I'm all for it. Focus drives behavior, but that's not enough. Everyone can do something.
You're right. We talk about leading from the seat you sit in, right? To your point, everyone can do something. Well, Dr. Barber, I thank you so much for being on this 2024 Women's History Month episode. Thank you for your leadership, your contributions to the community. And as I said, I will see you at the next Indiana Fever game.
Let's go Fever. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again to Dr. Allison Barber, and thanks to you for joining us on this 32nd episode of IBJ's The Freedom Forum with Angela B. Freeman. Please come back next month for another conversation about diversity, equity, and inclusion in the Central Indiana business community.